From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The CDC is out with those new guidelines for reopening key aspects of American life, including public transportation, schools, restaurants. When it's time for kids to go back to school, the CDC suggests keeping desks 6 feet apart, serving food in the classroom, not cafeterias. What's not mentioned in the 60-page document, any reference to communities of faith or churches. The White House objected to those mentions in earlier drafts.
These guidelines come as the number of new cases and deaths are subsiding in parts of the country. But progress is still slow in other parts. Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Chicago have seen cases plateau but not go down. And for more on that, let's check in on Chicago with Kristen Schorsch. She is WBEZ's government and politics reporter, and she joins us now. And Kristen, the number of new coronavirus infections in Chicago is not going up, but as I mentioned, it's not going down either. What are health experts saying about what's going on there?
Yeah, we're kind of in this plateau phase. There are some encouraging signs in Illinois. So around the state, there are fewer COVID-19 patients hospitalized, fewer in ICU beds for the sickest patients or on ventilators to help them breathe than at any point in more than 5 weeks. And experts say that this is a sign that the pandemic could be easing up here. So that's a really good thing. But I would say the state's not out of the woods yet. You know, we're doing a lot more testing. So you're going to see a lot more confirmed cases that way. But there, of course, are still deaths. Illinois has almost 100,000 diagnosed cases and more than 4,000 people have died of COVID-19.
Zooming into Chicago, how does that city compare to the state overall?
Well, so the city is the epicenter of the coronavirus in Illinois. We have almost 40% of all cases and deaths. But Chicago is also rolling out more testing, especially to communities of color that have much higher rates than other racial groups impacted by the virus. And so with more testing, you know, you're going to get more confirmed cases. But overall, things are looking better. You know, the governor has a reopening plan that is, you know, has five phases. Chicago and the rest of Illinois are right now in phase two. And a key metric of advancing to phase three is the rate of positive COVID cases. And right now, Chicago's positivity rate is now just shy of 18%. That's below the governor's threshold. So that basically means that Chicago can start moving into this phase three and start to reopen the economy slowly.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Mayor Lightfoot's plans, and do they coincide with the governor's plans? As you mentioned, he has said that he wants to lift the stay-at-home order on May 29th.
Yeah, so the mayor's approach here is basically, like, the bottom line is it's stricter than the governor's. So she has higher standards for things like the percentage of testing she wants done, you know, every day. So that's around 4,500 people, or about 5% of the city's population a month. She also wants a lower rate of positive cases in the state. So the governor has said, you know, 20% of cases can be positive for us to move forward. Chicago wants 15% of those cases to be positive. The mayor is giving a little bit more leeway to places where there are obviously lots of folks in close proximity, like nursing homes and jails. Those can have 30% of cases be positive. So overall, it seems like if there are, you know, are more outbreaks at jails or nursing homes, but that positivity rate is 30 or less, the city can still move forward.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about the state legislature. It's meeting today for the first time in 11 weeks. What are some things you're watching out for there?
Yeah, there are like three big buckets, and this is just this big emergency three-day session. So it's a very narrow time frame to get things done. But basically, the immediate concern for the state is passing the state budget. The fiscal year here starts on July 1. And the state is facing a nearly $3 billion budget shortfall for this current budget year. So there's a lot on that plate. They're also weighing an economic relief package. So this could involve increasing rent and mortgage assistance for families and small businesses. And they also plan to talk about legislation that would expand voting by mail in the fall. You know, they don't want all these people lining up at the polls, potentially not social distancing or wearing masks, and spreading COVID as they vote.
That's Kristen Schorsch with WBEZ. She is the government and politics reporter there. Kristen, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look now at the CARES Act. That's the coronavirus relief bill signed into law back in March. It provides $500 billion for the Treasury Department and Federal Reserve to lend to businesses and states. But a report from the bipartisan Congressional Oversight Commission earlier this week said the Treasury had spent almost none of that money. This came up yesterday at the hearing where senators grilled Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Fed Chair Jerome Powell. Powell said that getting these lending programs up and running is complex and challenging, especially the Main Street lending program, given the diverse needs of small and medium-sized companies. He says the program should all be up and running by the end of this month or early next, but still lots of questions. And the four-person oversight commission, which published that report, doesn't even have a chair yet. Let's bring in French Hill, Republican congressman from Arkansas, sole House Republican on the commission. Congressman, a question I know you're getting asked a lot, asked in the hearings yesterday. What happened?
Well, Robin, it's great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation. Well, not only is it $500 billion of taxpayer money that's been dedicated to these economic preservation programs that the U.S. Treasury and the Fed are operating, but it can be leveraged up to $5 trillion. And that's why Congress and the CARES Act set up this oversight commission. It's true that setting up these facilities is complicated because the Fed and the Treasury are going in a new direction. This is very different than the 08-09 financial crisis.
Well, let's just talk a second about that, because you do compare it to that in the writing. In the 08-09 housing collapse crisis, part of the problem was fixing a man-made problem. This, as you say, is an invader. That almost feels like it's an easier thing to do. Get that money to the people who need it.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, of course, the Congress has gotten money out to families, money for testing, money to hospitals. And the PPP program, the SBA program, the Paycheck Protection Program, has helped millions of small businesses with over $500 billion of direct assistance. These programs are now going beyond those small businesses into more complex areas like helping the airlines and helping state and local governments with short-term municipal finance and helping larger businesses. You referred to the Main Street program. So the Treasury set that up. They funded it and then issued a term sheet to American business and American financial institutions to see if they will find it attractive. And I think that's what Jay Powell and Steven Mnuchin were referring to yesterday when the complication. They want to make sure the program they structure will actually help the majority of businesses. So they've amended it based on about 2,000 public comments, and they hope to get it up and running next week. I wish it had been sooner, no doubt. Next week, we'll start seeing American business take action and borrow the money from the Main Street program.
You wrote that part of what the CARES Act did was establish a robust special inspector general at the U.S. Treasury Department to help kind of oversee this and make sure there was transparency. What we've been watching, though, under the Trump administration is the firing of inspectors general who dared to question what their different agencies might be doing. How can we have any assurance that an inspector general, and one has been nominated, although not confirmed, how can we, you know, have any assurance that there will be transparency and that there will be somebody who will dare to question? Because we see what happens when inspectors general do.
Robin, great point. The Congress is very concerned about oversight, which is why they set up this commission. But they also set up a coordinating board for all inspectors general at all the cabinet agencies and appointed a special inspector general at the Treasury. They are looking for gaps in these programs, failures to conform to Congress's interest. Plus, Congress appropriated extra money for the Government Accounting Office to report to Congress monthly and to the public quarterly. So you'll have a lot of oversight of the $3 trillion that was in the CARES Act to put out to help kill the virus and get our economy back to full capacity.
Just one last quick question. One of your colleagues, the Republican Pat Toomey, said he's worried if this money isn't dispersed soon, it will be too late. There's just going to be companies that fold, gears that grind to a halt in the economy. Are you concerned?
I think Pat Toomey is right, and that's why last week when Vice Chairman of the Fed Quarles, Randy Quarles, said that it could be weeks for the Main Street facility to be up and running, I was concerned and voiced that concern, and why I was very pleased that Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, and Jay Powell, the Fed Chair, yesterday said, no, it will be up and running before the end of the month, May, or early first couple of days of June. We need to get out and be working in the marketplace with the Main Street program. If the Fed and the Treasury need to change the term sheet to make it more effective, they can do that as they go along. But financing takes time, and we are the time is the enemy when it comes to getting this economy back up and running.
That's Arkansas Representative French Hill, member of the Congressional Oversight Commission. Congressman Hill, thank you and best of luck to you.
Robin, thanks for having me. Look forward to coming back.
These days, so many companies are asking for employees to sacrifice, take pay cuts or work less hours for the collective good of the company. At Tribune Publishing, though, many employees are not buying it. The newspaper chain owns big dailies like the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News, and smaller papers, too, in cities like Allentown, Pennsylvania. And these newsrooms have endured waves of cuts for years. Now, Tribune journalists nationwide say they are trying to hold the line against more layoffs and a new owner, a hedge fund they believe is solely focused on profits. NPR's David Folkenflik has the story.
The scenario is familiar. A sober-minded CEO sitting at home, addressing the troops appreciatively by video. In this case, Tribune Publishing's Terry Jimenez, who warns about the future after the pandemic fades.
We will be a different company on the other side of this. We will need to be structured differently. We need to think differently. We will need to be more flexible.
This from audio of the event obtained by NPR. Flexible means 3 weeks of unpaid furloughs for each Tribune journalist, and permanent pay cuts in some newsrooms for people who make more than $67,000 a year. Many Tribune journalists say they're at breaking point.
We have members who are selling plasma to help pay for their groceries and their bills.
Sarah Gregory covers education for the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk and is chair of the local Tidewater Media Guild.
We have folks making lots of sacrifices to do the jobs that they feel called to.
There are real pressures on the news business, and the pandemic triggered a real financial tailspin as newspaper advertising dried up. Yet, Tribune journalists across the company tell NPR they have lost faith in their executives. The Tribune acquired the Virginian Pilot in 2018, then combined its newsroom with that of the Newport News Daily Press, and cut the number of journalists almost in half. Sarah Gregory says that's hurt the community.
I get messages from sources saying, you know, why didn't the paper cover this, or why didn't the paper cover that? And a lot of times the answer is just manpower, right? Like, there are only so many things that we can do with the people that we have.
Several weeks ago, scores of journalists across Tribune took to the internal messaging platform Slack for a digital protest, tagging CEO Jimenez in each comment. NPR reviewed transcripts. 3 weeks' pay is 3 months' mortgage, wrote a reporter from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Another from Chicago wrote, the furloughs were catastrophic. Quote, we're already living paycheck to paycheck. The federal government has boosted unemployment benefits to deal with the larger economic fallout of the crisis, and Tribune is telling its less well-paid employees they could earn more on unpaid furlough than from their regular pay. Here's Jimenez during that town hall.
So I fully understand there's a sacrifice. In some circumstances, at the low end of the comp scale, you actually have a chance to make more money.
Jimenez and Tribune declined to comment for this story. For years, while the company's newsrooms keep getting leaner, top executives have made millions. So too have shareholders through dividends, though the company did cancel its next payout, giving in to union pressure. All that makes journalists skeptical of the newsroom cuts, which aim to preserve less than $600,000 company-wide. Again, CEO Terry Jimenez.
It does save the company money, which is desperately needed at this time.
It is, however, less money than the company will pay in severance just to one executive who's leaving this month. At the Baltimore Sun, journalists and leading community organizations are trying to break this cycle. Tribune has already slashed the Sun's newsroom to less than a quarter of where it once stood.
it's been very worrisome and troubling, the downsizing that's happened at the Baltimore Sun and really newspapers across the country.
Matt Gallagher is president and CEO of the Goldsecker Foundation. Along with the Able Foundation and the local news union, it is trying to buy the Sun from Tribune Publishing and turn it into a nonprofit.
Really, there is no institution that I can think of that is more central to the day-to-day life of the city than the Baltimore Sun. And a free and independent and robust, you know, local newspaper. I mean, it literally is part of the daily fabric of what happens in Baltimore every single day.
He says that is more important than boosting profits, which is why journalists are looking warily toward the end of June, when the hedge fund Alden Global Capital can take full control of Tribune Publishing. Alden is already the largest single investor in the company. It now owns 200 news publications. Its track record suggests even more severe budget cuts could be coming to Tribune soon. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Disney is now taking the first steps towards reopening in the United States. Today, some of its Disney Springs shops and restaurants open to the public. Last week, it was Disneyland in Shanghai. And even though the Disney Corporation has put rules in place, like requiring people wear face masks and undergo temperature checks, the company has also issued a warning, saying, come at your own risk. Martin Lewison is a business management professor, and he's also known as Professor Rollercoaster. He focuses on the theme park industry at Farmingdale State College in New York. Martin, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
So there are no dates yet for when Disney will reopen its theme parks, but what do you make of their warning to the public? Does it absolve them from liability if someone gets COVID-19 on their property?
Well, there is a certain degree of risk that's taken upon by visitors. Disney's really being as transparent as they can be, saying that we're taking whatever reasonable precautions we can to make it a safe place to go, but ultimately we can't be held responsible. Now, whether they can or cannot be held liable ultimately would end up in the courts if somebody were to actually sue.
Yeah. But I think a lot of people were surprised by Disney's statement, basically come at your own risk, a place that is often so welcoming and providing an experience for people at all of their places.
Yes. Disney theme parks are designed, you know, in such a way that you put the outside world aside and enter a new realm of magic and fantasy. You know, that's a little bit of a slap in the face to the person that's trying to fantasize when they come in and says, oh, by the way, you may catch an, you know, life-threatening illness. But on the other hand, I think guests will be taking taking some sort of risk that wasn't there in the past. I mean, anybody can stumble when they're getting off a theme park ride and break their leg, and those kinds of risks always exist. And we sort of assume those risks without thinking. But yep. Disney wants to remind you that now there's a new risk. And it does kind of take the sheen off the fantasy, but I hope it has the effect of making guests be that much more careful, that guests should be careful about wearing a mask, that guests should be careful about keeping distance, you know, from other parties in the park. And if that communal behavior leads to fewer infections overall, then I think the warning serves a purpose other than legal protection.
Your nickname, as I mentioned, is Professor Rollercoaster, because you and your wife are really theme park enthusiasts. You say you visit more than 100 theme parks a year. If you could go back one day soon, would you?
I would. The truth is that it's really my wife, I think, that's putting the brakes on things. I'm not anxious to go out, but we do live right in the middle of Queens, and it's been hard hit here. And my wife happens to be an ER doctor. So my wife is seen COVID-19 way up close. She's definitely spooked about going out in public, and there are definitely some risks to going back to large gatherings of people at this stage of the game. So I'm certainly excited about the season possibly reopening, but I think that, as I said, my wife is a little bit more on the cautious side, and you know, she's my riding buddy. So we're probably not going to be going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about theme parks are really large public gatherings. even if there are all of these precautions in place. And we're talking about Disney in this discussion, but I'm thinking about some of those other types of theme parks, smaller ones like Six Flags and Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. Do you think that they will survive moving forward if they have to stay closed during what is usually a peak season, the spring and the summer and early fall?
Well, I do think that parks like Disney, when they open, I think they'll do it right. And, you know, they're going to operate at much lower than normal capacity. And typically at a theme park, you're outdoors. So it's not like being, you know, caught inside in a small space with other people. So there are certainly some risks, but I think Disney and the other large companies are going to try to manage the risks as well as they can. And in fact, Disney has the deepest pockets, but I also think that companies like Universal, you know, basically the big six, seven, Disney, Universal, Six Flags, Cedar Fair, SeaWorld Entertainment, and then there are a couple of foreign-owned chains, Parques Reunidos and Merlin Entertainments. They operate the Legolands. You know, I think those companies are going to get through it. I think this is clearly going to be a difficult period for all of them. I'm more worried about the smaller parks, the regional parks, the mom and pop owned parks that have been in a single family for generations. You know, there are like 5,000 different amusement and attractions companies in the United States. You know, if you take every amusement park, water park, and family entertainment center, you know, there's more than 5,000 of them. So there are definitely some that are going to be under pressure. Hopefully much of the industry will survive. But of course, it's not just the theme park industry. Anything related to entertainment, travel, tourism is under pressure right now.
That's Martin Lewison. He is a business management professor who focuses on the theme park industry at Farmingdale State College in New York. Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Some government officials in Mexico are pushing back against the president's plans to reopen parts of the economy. COVID-19 cases are surging in the country, and health officials acknowledge the death toll may be even higher than they're calculating. NPR's Carrie Kahn joins us now from Mexico City. And Carrie, tell us about this pushback from some of those local health officials there. They're not reopening as the president said they should.
Well, there are around 300 municipalities on this list. They're called Towns of Hope, where they haven't had any COVID cases. But the majority of them are in the southern states like Oaxaca, and the governor there said now is not the time to reopen. Some of these towns are in very poor areas, and they don't have any health facilities. You know, they closed up early knowing that they couldn't handle any sort of outbreak. You've also heard similar comments from governors in other states around the country. They seem not so eager to open up, especially to start up schools.
You laid out some of those rural areas and some of the challenges they're dealing with. How bad is the coronavirus situation in the country overall?
It's getting bad. So far, there's over 50,000 confirmed cases, and deaths are creeping up to about 6,000. But you have to keep in mind when you hear all these numbers that Mexico is not doing a lot of testing. This is a country of about 125 million, and they've only done about 150,000 tests to date. That's one of the lowest testing rates in the world. I went out recently and I went to the general hospital here, and I do talk to nurses and doctors around the country, and, you know, they're exhausted. Mm. They're sad watching so many deaths, and they're worried. One of their biggest worries is whether they'll still have equipment and protective gear to last them through the whole outbreak. So there's a lot of concern and a lot of independent media reporting that the undercount of especially the dead here in Mexico City, one report showed a database of suspected deaths that could be three times lower than people that really have died of COVID. Officials even acknowledge that, you know, bureaucratic lag times and minimal testing have led to an undercount.
Given all of this, why is the president suggesting the country reopen back up?
Well, it's not the total. It's not the whole country opening. It's just a few counties where there is no virus. But in places where there have been virus outbreaks and there are key industries, he's saying it's time to open up. And those key industries are construction, mining, and especially the auto factories here. They're key in the U.S.-Mexico supply chain for the auto industry. And he's under a lot of pressure from the U.S. to open up those key industries for the supply chain. He's also under a lot of pressure at home, because the economy is tanking fast here.
Yeah.
So that it's a combination of the two, the pressure from the U.S. and also his own ideas that the lockdown isn't really strategically needed, and it may be doing more harm to the poor in the country by taking away their economic activity than the virus itself.
But you've reported that there have been COVID-19 cases in some of these plants that supply U.S. businesses. Some workers have even died.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation, especially in the Maquila, the manufacturing plants up at the border. There have been dozens of deaths reported there. The president says what the companies will now have to do is promise to monitor all employees going in and out, like temperature taking and providing masks and goggles. But the government is outright saying that they're just trusting the companies to comply and will only randomly inspect. So we're going to have to watch carefully how this limited reopening goes about.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Mexico City. Carrie, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Connecticut begins its first phase of reopening today. Restaurants can now offer dining outdoors only. Malls, stores, and offices can reopen with some restrictions. Democratic Governor Ned Lamont won't allow salons and barbers to open yet. He said workers told him they weren't ready with protection or child care. And 11 state senators asked the governor to delay the whole reopening to get more testing and preparation. Democratic State Senator Saud Anwar was one of them. He's also a frontline doctor. So, Senator, doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
And talk about your concern about the state opening, because Governor Lamont says there's been a nearly four-week drop in the number of hospitalizations from COVID-19. He said the state is 53% below the peak. What are your biggest fears?
Robin, first, I want to just mention that I think the governor and his team are doing an excellent job in very difficult circumstances. I can tell you the overarching issues that I think are worthy to consider. The state of Connecticut is one of the fourth most densely populated states in the country. The case fatality rate, which means that the number of people who got infected and the number of people who died, is the highest in the country.
You mean neighboring New York? And by the way, a lot of people from New York live in Connecticut. More people who get sick in Connecticut die from COVID-19 than even, you know, the same equation in New York?
Yes, New York and New Jersey, if you look at the numbers. So the case fatality rate basically is the total number of people who developed the disease and the total number of people who have died from the disease. So the death divided by the total cases, multiply that by 100, that's the case fatality rate. New York and New Jersey are behind us.
And is it fair to say that's because in Connecticut, I think 50% of your tragic deaths have come from people in nursing homes?
That is true. And we are the sixth most older state in the country. And then the next point is that the healthcare disparities in the state of Connecticut are much higher than we have in other states. We have some of the richest and the most affluent neighborhoods. And about 10-minute drive from there, we have the poorest of the poor neighborhoods. While the disease spreads equally amongst people, but because of the socioeconomic status and how the state has been set up, has allowed the disease to spread much more within our minority communities in inner cities. So if you look at this broader issue, we have to have pause and respect before we make a major decision.
You're a doctor. You're a practicing physician. You've treated patients. We're going to speak next to a diner owner. You know, the pain of people who have been losing money, maybe losing businesses, is palpable. You know that. They feel that they can make it safe, but they may not make it if they don't get that chance to try to make it safe. What would you say to them?
So I can first say to them that I truly understand and recognize and respect what you're experiencing. And we can do better by being better prepared to allow you to open your business But at the same time, make sure that you and your family and your workers and your customers are all safe. Now, I have seen the ugly face of this disease. When you see people in their 30s or people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s die, you have to have respect for the disease. And I would not want it to happen to any single person anywhere if I have a way to do this.
It must be horrible to see people not be able to breathe.
It changes you. And these patients should have had full lives had it not been for COVID. Here we are, and then you're seeing so many people in minority communities. And when certain people are impacted more so, yes, it is the virus, but also it is the overall situation of how health and healthy living and healthy opportunities are different for different people in our state.
That's Connecticut State Senator Saud Anwar, also a medical doctor who treats patients with COVID-19. Senator Anwar, Dr. Anwar, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Robin.
Well, let's bring in that diner owner. David Agostino owns the Bedford Street Diner in Stamford, Connecticut, about 40 miles outside New York City. David, State Senator Anwar wants just a pause, you know, more testing and preparation. Why not wait, even just 1 week more?
Well, I mean, I guess I could live with 1 week, but as of now, our governor, Lamont, has already declared that there will be no inside dining until June 20th. So that's another month. I mean, in my mind, we were told, I think it was March 17th, to essentially close our business is doing takeout and delivery. Bars, salons, gyms, they were literally had to lock their doors to flatten the curve. And a lot of the citizens of Connecticut feel like we did that. It's flattened. So what are we doing now? Well, what are we waiting for? So every germ in the state is gone?
And by the way, it sounds like you're saying you feel like you were good citizens, and today you start outside sidewalk dining. Delivery. We're hearing in some places, like in the North End in Boston, that delivery ability maybe was 5% of what they need to keep going. How about with you? How much did that give you?
I would say between takeout and delivery, I'm down about 82% without the indoor dining.
And by the way, are you getting any help for that? Any supplemental aid?
We did get the PPP, as it's very well documented. The PPP does not work well for restaurants or gyms. Number one, it took too long, and by the time I finally got my hands on it, two of my employees went on unemployment. I couldn't blame them with that extra $600 bonus that the government lapped in there. Yeah. It really wasn't good for restaurants and gyms. But I did get that, and the staff that did stay, I can use that to pay them.
Let's remind people, business owners had to spend 75% of that PPP on employee payroll. But like many business owners, you wish you had more of that money to pay things like utilities and rent. And now outside dining, what percentage is that going to give you?
I have no idea. We've never really had it. You know, we barely ever have put tables outside. Should it be an uptick? Right. Yes. But nothing's going to make up for, you know, when you have a busy weekend inside a diner.
I got to tell you, for parts of the country that don't have diners, it's inconceivable to see table, like a cafe setting, outside of a diner. Because the whole experience is packed into your booths in the diner, and there's a place where you can sit at the counter, and it's one after the other.
All our chairs are turned upside down on tables. It's a very sad sight.
Yeah, I bet it is. And what precautions are you taking for the outside dining?
We're following all the rules that the governor wanted. We have going to have sanitizers. We're going to have single serve mustard, sugar, creamers. We have the utensils that are plastic that are wrapped individually, wipe down each table after every use. We're going to, with a waitress today, we'll wear a mask, gloves.
Well, and are you concerned about your waitresses and your workers? Are they concerned?
No. Well, right now, the only workers are my cooks are in the back, so they're not coming into contact with the actual customers. But me, my sisters, and my mother are doing the waitressing. So, are they concerned? Not that much. Are we more concerned about losing a business we built for 13 years? Yes.
Yeah. I have this feeling, Stamford being such a bustling place anyway, but it's also, you know, between New York and Boston, people travel on 95 like crazy back and forth. I feel you're going to have customers, but are you on pins and needles about what you will see?
I don't know about pins and needles. I'm curious to see how many people will come out. Like I said, we have managed to stay afloat, but it's going to be up to our landlord. You know, I'm 2 months down on rent. If he demands every penny in full from these months, then we're not going to make it. And that's the case for other places I've talked to around town. Because in the little strip mall area, you know, you've been here, I don't know if you remember the other stores, we have a dry cleaner that can't pay the electricity because everyone's working from home and no one's getting their clothes pressed. A Chinese restaurant that went out of business, now they're trying to come back. And a Rite Aid, which is probably making 10 times more than everybody, so that he's fine there.
Yeah. Look, looking ahead, are you worried about how you're going to keep people safe inside? I mean, what are you going to do? What are your plans for inside the restaurant?
We'll have people wear masks. We'll have the gloves. We'll have the sanitizer. So, you know, Well, you know, we're in the process of getting a, you know, paper menu. So whatever the rules apply, we're going to follow them to the best of our ability. I mean, you also look, I mean, what is Target doing? What is Home Depot doing? They've been open from the get-go. I mean, just because they have arrows stuck on the floor to tell you where to go, they're more equipped than me and my staff, my whole family, to run our business.
I hear you. And yet what they say is that you spend far less time in those places and you're far separated from people because they're limiting how many can come in. Where when people are in a restaurant, it's an intimate experience, and that's the concern.
Yeah, I mean, Walmart, Target, they're touching everything on the shelf, going by. One's going this way, one's going that way. I just don't, you know, if they're going to be open, you know, are they an essential business? My sister has three kids. My other sister has three kids. We have three houses between us. I mean, you know, my diner is essential to me.
Yeah. Well, Dave Agostino, I know people think that diners are essential, and I hope you have a terrific day. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and yeah, good luck to you guys, and hopefully we'll see the other end of this soon enough.
Before the pandemic, more than 37 million people in our country struggled with hunger and food insecurity. Now, with unemployment soaring, that number is much higher and growing. Food banks throughout the country are scrambling to meet the demand. And today, we check in on a food pantry in Houston. Kathy Moore is the executive director of Echoes, a nonprofit that's helping distribute food in the city. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you so much for taking the time. And Kathy, we have seen those aerial shots of those long car lines that span city blocks at food pantries in Houston. And this is really the case throughout the country. I know that most of your clients are families who are poor or homeless. In a normal week, you all see about 100 clients. What is it like now?
We are now seeing 750 families a week. Our clients are mostly out of jobs. They're the mixed status families, undocumented families, and other vulnerable groups. And it's overwhelming because we don't have enough staff or enough volunteers. We're not able to do as much as we wish that we could.
Give us a sense of what a day is like. That's such a huge jump in the number of folks that you all see now each week. I know that they used to be able to come in and choose the food and talk with you all. And now because of social distancing, it's curbside.
Right. So first thing we have to do is bring all the food outside every day. We have to bag it before we get it out there. And then we have to set all the tables up and get everything going, get the security to keep the lines orderly and organized because tempers are hot and people are impatient and the lines are long. And you can understand that, right? Having to wait 2 hours in a line to get food.
That's happening for you all on a daily basis.
Absolutely, it's happening. When I arrive at six, between 6:30 a.m. and 7 a.m., they're already lining up in their cars.
I know that you all have this system in place now where folks, you're trying to make it as efficient as possible. Are there people who are wanting to have conversations with you all, though? And if you are having conversations, what are they telling you? What are you hearing from people?
We've had a lot of new clients that are fearful because they've never been in this position before. Families who have never been out of a job, never been able to put food on a table, and now they're having to ask for help, and they need other services too. So they're asking us about how they can access rental assistance or utility assistance. We have been trying to offset the food we put in their cars with food vouchers, as well as gift cards for food so that families can go to the grocery store and buy the items that they like and their family uses. So we try to hand out protein and cereals for the children and spaghetti sauce and canned chicken and salmon are a premium for us, right? We love to get that in the door.
How are you all able to sustain? Again, that is a huge jump from 100 families to now almost 1,000 families. Where are you getting the food from, and how are you sustaining your pantry?
So we're getting our food from the Houston Food Bank. We're also getting it from another nonprofit here in town. And then we have families that are kind, that are not in need, and they will come with boxed foods and bagged foods so that we can distribute it.
Yeah. You know, I can hear in your voice, Kathy, the drive of someone who is really passionate about what one does. At the same time, this has to be extremely exhausting. What are you most concerned about right now?
I am most concerned about my staff, to be honest, right now. We have been running at a sprint level for, I would say, 9 weeks. Since about March 15th is kind of our litmus test as to when we started this. And we're 9 weeks in, and staff is tired. We're only going to be able to distribute food 3 days a week going forward. It's too much of a burden. So we'll still be serving the same number of families a week.
It looks like this is not going to end anytime soon. What is your call to action?
So for us, it's the need for volunteers. And if we need volunteers, then people in the communities that are hearing this message, there are nonprofits in your community that need volunteers too, because it's really hard doing this work without help. We need funding to keep food in our pantry, and we also need funding to purchase gift cards and food vouchers so our families can buy perishable food items that they want and that their family likes.
That's Kathy Moore. She's the executive director of ECHOS, a nonprofit organization that's helping to distribute food in Houston, Texas. Kathy, thank you so much for talking with us and for your work.
Tanya, thank you so much, and thanks for reaching out to us.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.